Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA, and today we're going to talk about the hidden costs of moving goods around the world. We'll board a super-sized cargo ship at the Port of Long Beach. It's the largest container ship to ever dock in the U.S.
It's as wide as a 12-lane freeway, and this is a fascinating statistic. It is able to hold 90 million pairs of shoes, and for those of us who love our stilettos, that's just an amazing statistic.
Before we get to that, though, many of you may consider billboards a blight, especially when they're digital. Not the city of West Hollywood, though, at least if billboards are creative. The city's currently working on ordinances, an environmental impact report, and now a Sunset Spectacular design competition, all aimed at making the Sunset Strip the spectacle it was back in the last century. John D'Amico is a West Hollywood City Council member.
You know, billboards around the turn of the century became the flattest media around. There was more going on in our handhelds than on the billboards. And we're trying to flip that around again and make a drive down the Sunset Strip with its exciting curve and its years and decades of glamour once again a very exciting fun thing to do on a Saturday night.
Just for, when you say the strip used to be entertaining or the billboards used to be entertaining, what was entertaining about them?
Well, it came in a lot of different packages. They were at one time hand-painted and fresh out of the record studios. They would be painted and you could go to the Sunset Strip and see what new albums were going to be released. You could go to the Sunset Strip and see a 3D billboard of the Jaws movie. At one time, there was a competition and people lived on the billboards on the Sunset Strip. There just was a sort of continuous reinvention of the culture. We lost that. The city can never dictate content of billboards, and we wouldn't try, but we can create an environment in which a reflection of the inventing culture starts to show up, and we can sort of lose the bank ads, perhaps, and get a more exciting set of advertisement around fashion or movies or music or whatever sort of dynamic things are happening in the culture.
In other parts of the region, specifically the city of Los Angeles, there was a big fight around billboards, particularly digital ones, and one of the big complaints was these big blaring digital billboards can be distracting to drivers. It sounds as if the point on the strip is to distract the drivers.
Well, I certainly don't want to go on record saying that we're trying to distract drivers, but I will go on record to say that the Sunset Strip provides a very unique opportunity in Southern California to be driving and observing the landscape. Some people have referred to the Sunset Strip in that area that it will become an architectural petting zoo, in that, you know, we have all these existing architectural gems from Crescent Heights to Doheny, and we have four or five more coming, and this will just add to the environment of really being a place where you can come and see people, come and see architecture, come and see design, come and listen to music, come and have a great meal. It's really sort of a 21st century environment, taking advantage of the fact that we still drive cars.
And frankly, it's not as if the cars go very fast on the street.
Yes, exactly. Here.
If you're going 2 miles an hour, it doesn't really matter if your eyeballs pop.
It doesn't matter much. We want people to be safe, but you can take a nice slow trip down the Sunset Strip and have a great time along the way.
That's John D'Amico. So the city invited teams of designers and signage companies to offer up ideas for a new billboard at a site at Sunset and Holloway owned by the city. They told teams to dream up a concept for 1,000 square feet of digital signage and 500 square feet of static signage. They gave them limitations on height and the brightness of the sign, and they asked them to consider the area around the base of the sign. The project's called Sunset Spectacular, and that's a name that suggests they're aiming high. Bianca Siegel is long-range and mobility planning manager for the City of West Hollywood.
Spectacular, we've learned through this process, is an industry term that means a non-standard sign. And so we're with that term, we're speaking to the sign industry and trying to generate interest from them in participating in a what we hope is a really positive and exciting process of increasing the creativity and quality of these signs and see how they can, you know, address placemaking, digital technology, and contribute to the excitement of the strip.
What does a digital billboard have to do with placemaking?
Great question. That's something that we're trying to answer with this project. You know, at its most basic form, I would say not at all, or they have the potential to detract. And what we're looking at in this pilot project and with our policy changes is to see if it's possible with appropriate guidelines in the right place and with excellent design, if there's the potential to have them contribute positively to the environment.
Las Vegas has some pretty amazing signs, and many of them digital. Do you want to go Las Vegas or away from Las Vegas?
We don't want to go Las Vegas. We're uniquely West Hollywood. We really want to embrace our identity as a, you know, as a smaller creative city with some really exciting destinations.
Last week, four shortlisted teams presented their concepts to the public. Each of the teams promised a mix of art and advertising. Each of them imagined community activities at the base of the sign. And each of them made a point of interactivity with the sign. First up, we heard from Tom Wiscombe, who's teamed with Orange Barrel Media and Mocha.
We're not just talking about a billboard here. We're talking about, in my opinion, a whole new type of urban space.
He presented a sign made of three angular sides that he referred to as petals.
On the outside of it, you have commercial media and also the ability to have site-specific artworks on it. And then there's an interior world, which there's a kind of interior structure. You can go inside and you can interact with it live with your smartphone. And our proposal, we're calling it a bell tower because we want the billboard to be thought of as something that communicates civic qualities, that communicates things that are really deep in human consciousness, like bell towers, clock towers, obelisks, and those kinds of structures. And so we're comparing it to the Piazza San Marco in Venice in the sense of having a plaza with a vertical clock tower attached.
Next was the architecture office of Gensler with Outfront Media and the Max Center for Art and Architecture. Their scheme rejected the idea of one sign, replacing it instead with an outdoor room of screens that passers-by would interact with, primarily through projecting their so-called sunset selfies onto a large screen. Roger Sherman is Senior Urban Projects Director at Gensler.
We thought a little bit about what this might mean in terms of the change from the 2D of the Marlboro Man to the 3D of digital technology. So our idea was to create a kind of sound and light stage, or a media tech, outdoor media tech, for the naturally occurring drama that is life on the strip to reflect back on itself as well as to broadcast to the world at large.
Tate Towers is a staging and scenic design company with lots of experience staging rock concerts and huge spectacles. They proposed what they called Vortex, a 70-foot-tall steel structure with a high-resolution display on a double-sided screen made of 14 individually rotating blades. Tyler Casera described its impact.
So an important part of the Vortex is this kind of combination, this melding of obviously advertising and art. We have this opportunity to have content and art actually influence the physical form of the Vortex itself.
There was one presentation that had an unanticipated poignancy. It was by the team of sign company J.C. DeCoe and Zaha Hadid. Now, she's the renowned architect who passed away on March 31st. Before she died, she and her team had developed a design in which the sign would be a dramatic sculpture of metal leaf-like shapes atop a stalk. Her longtime design partner, Patrick Schumacher, gave the presentation.
We decided to do something quite light touch, inobtrusive, elegant, the pursuit of beauty. This is not a billboard for us. This is a interactive animated sculpture, a work of art in its own right. It is designed 360 degree. There's no front nor backside, but all around it's shifting the silhouette as you move around. And I think it will be a lovely and delightful place to gather around. And that's the new idea here, I guess, to create a space of interaction.
Now West Hollywood staff will consider all four schemes and deliver a verdict by the end of the month. Back to Councilman John D'Amico.
This is so exciting to me. I mean, this is almost the only reason I wanted to be elected, was to really think about the built environment in West Hollywood and how that can really affect people's lives for the better. And I just think that if we're going to have billboards and we're going to really make the best of the Sunset Strip, this is one way for us to do it.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. See a video of all the presentations on our website. As mentioned earlier, one of the finalists is the office of the late Zaha Hadid, whose numerous buildings include the Contemporary Arts Centre in Cincinnati, the Maxi Museum in Rome, and the London Aquatic Centre. When she died, she left a thriving firm with 400 employees and projects on all continents at all scales and stages. So what does a firm do when its leader and namesake passes? I talked about this with Patrick Schumacher, who's director at Zaha Hadid Architects.
I imagine it must be a great void in your life having her gone.
Oh, that's absolutely true, and it's very difficult to get used to it, even because I've been talking to her literally every day on the phone. I've seen her every day, worked with her, traveled with her for the last 28 years. So you can imagine that it's very difficult to get used to. Whenever the phone is ringing, it usually would have been her. So. It's been still too fresh to be fully adapted into a world without Zaha.
And her name defined the firm. She has a huge personality that defined the firm. What do you do when you have the challenge of continuing a firm that was so strongly defined by one individual?
Well, one major challenge is the perception in the world at large, less so the perception within the field and discipline. And we actually have been working with Zaha, many of us, for so many years, in my person now 27 and a half years, and we've built the firm together, we've co-authored most of the projects, and we are working in ways which we have been working and continuing to work, which allow for many creatives to come together under a set of principles, the DNA which we've evolved over those years, so that can continue. The question and challenge is, will that be credible to the world at large, to clients who don't know us intimately, to the general public, which might invite us or not invite us through certain political leaders into projects of cultural significance? But this is the kind of project we can address, and the kind of project we must continue to seek. So that is a big challenge, but I think Zaha was, before she became a global celebrity and known to a larger public, her reputation was built within the discipline. So there's a chance that I can project what my reputation, which is strong within the field, to let that come through to a larger audience, through critics, through colleagues, through my writings and lecturing, etc.
So Zaha definitely was the public face of the architecture. You have been, for a long time, the public face of the theory and the writing. You often use a term, well known within the architecture world, parametricism. Can you explain that?
Yes, these architectural forms can adapt, be modulated, and be much more free-form. And that's what parametricism signifies, that all the elements have parameters, which means degrees of freedom, to modulate, adapt, and fit themselves into complex scenarios.
But all of this is rooted in the language, if one can call it that, of digital design.
That's right. I mean, the digital design tools has given us, empowered us with new degrees of freedom, to maintain also order in the face of complexity, something which would be difficult to achieve by just the hand flowing or rulers and compass. And so we're relying on software, 3D modeling software. Some of it comes out of the animation industry, in fact, because in the animation industry, filmmakers wanted to model nature, wanted to model clouds, water flows, hairs flowing, cloth, and many different more organic and fluid elements which we observe in the natural world and the human world, not so much architectural, but those more organic and flowy forms can be simulated with these animation tools. And we picked on this because we had a desire to make architecture as malleable and fluid as those spaces and landscapes of nature. So we appropriated those tools, and this has really been empowering us to create and envision and design built environments of a nature-like intricacy.
That was Patrick Schumacher, director at Zaha Hadid Architects. Coming up, the global shipping system that we don't see, but is responsible for most of the things we buy.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. You know those metal shipping containers? The standard size is 20 feet long by 8 feet wide. Well, imagine a ship that can carry 18,000 of them. A few weeks ago, DNA producer Avishai Artsy and I went to the port of Long Beach and boarded the biggest ship ever to dock there. It's called the Benjamin Franklin. It's owned by the French company CMA-CGM, and it's named for America's first ambassador to France. The ship is as long as the Empire State Building is tall, or 4 football fields in length. The engine room alone looked like something out of a James Bond movie. Here's Ed McCarthy. He's chief operating officer for CMA-CGM America.
So the engine room is 3 stories tall, and it has 11 pistons that drive the engine. It has as much thrust as 11 747s. It has to move 200,000 tons through the water.
Then he led us down a very long hallway.
All right, so this corridor runs the length of the vessel. It is almost 1,300 feet long, okay? At sea, as you look down this corridor, it looks completely stable. At sea, the vessel moves in 6 different directions simultaneously, so the design of the vessel is to flex, and you can actually, as you're walking through this corridor, actually watch the vessel ebb and flow or hog and sag as it goes through the water.
CMA-CGM is in the midst of a kind of global arms race among shipping companies to build bigger and bigger container ships. Marc Bourdon is president of CMA-CGM America.
When you look at the amount of weight that retail has on the economy, you will find that the role that container shipping lines play is extremely important. And so we need to be able to grow with the market to sustain the economy as well overall.
Bourdon told us these ships are new to the US because the ports are only now building the infrastructure that can handle this kind of traffic. The Port of Long Beach is in the midst of a $4 billion overhaul of the port, expanding Middle Harbor with deeper docks and bigger cranes, and it's replacing the Gerald Desmond Bridge. More expansion is expected to take place next decade. And the port was expecting to wait a couple of years before the mega ships actually arrived, so they threw a big party to welcome the Ben Franklin. It began with a performance by a local a cappella group, singing the Star Spangled Banner and the Marseillaise, the French national anthem. Then shipping executives and local officials delivered speeches full of excitement, among them Laurie Anne Guzman, president of the Board of Harbor Commissioners.
It is able to hold 90 million pairs of shoes, and for those of us who love our stilettos, that's just an amazing statistic. Many of them, these shoes, probably headed to a Walmart near you.
Clearly, Walmart has a stake in those millions of pairs of shoes. The ceremony ended with Shelley McMillan, the wife of Walmart CEO Doug McMillan, christening the ship with a bottle of champagne.
I name this ship CMA-CGM Benjamin Franklin. Fair winds to the ship, the crew, and all who sail on her.
Now, all this sounded like the beginning of a quite spectacular business agreement. But despite the pomp and circumstance, it turns out that in late April, CMA CGM announced that they're cancelling plans to send megaships between Asia and the US West Coast. The company says it's because of weak market conditions in the Trans-Pacific market. But this doesn't change the fact that bigger is the future for container shipping. The biggest megaships now carry up to 20,000 TEUs. And it's the vast scale of today's transportation of goods, how that 90 million pairs of shoes, for example, makes its way from inception to Walmart to our homes, that has intrigued the journalist Edward Humes. His latest book is Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. And it looks at the overlapping impact of the movement of people and of goods.
What I tried to do is look at a day in the life of my own household, my family, you know, waking up. Where does the coffee come from? How does it get to us? My alarm clock is also my phone. So where did the parts of that originate? And what does it take to land an iPhone at my local store?
One of the theses of your book is that all this transportation has a deleterious effect on the environment.
Well, of course, transportation is a major contributor to carbon emissions. There's really no question about that. And these giant container ships are a major source of emissions. 2 to 3% of global carbon emissions come from the container fleet, and we're talking about 6,000 ships. They burn massive amounts of incredibly dirty fuel. If you look at their emissions of particulates and smog-causing emissions, 160 of those megaships are the equivalent of every car in the world, 160 out of 6,000. So they're massive emitters of all kinds of unfortunate substances, and you know they exist because that's how we move our goods. Now, the irony is the design of these vessels enables the makers of product to say, hey, we ship so much of this stuff this way that it's really very efficient. And if you look at the per product footprint, it's really relatively minute. And that's true. That is a factually accurate argument. But the reality is that if you look at just for U.S. carbon emissions, the transportation sector is number two, just slightly behind the generation of electricity. And it's number one by far in how much energy is wasted because our transportation systems, for all that efficiency of size that the shipping companies like to talk about, the way we use energy to move things is so wasteful that we're losing about 79% of the energy we put into the process, literally up in smoke.
So we recently went to Long Beach where we saw the christening of the new Benjamin Franklin massive container ship, biggest container ship so far to dock at Long Beach, mm-hmm. which is currently going through an expansion in order to accommodate these ever increasingly large container ships. The Long Beach port claims that at the same time as it's doing this expansion, it is also becoming greener and that these container ships are becoming greener. Is that true? Is that possible? Or is it a contradiction in terms?
Green is a relative term. Are they more efficient? If they're moving more goods more efficiently, then that argument has some merit. You got to understand what these ships burn, a product called bunker fuel. And I think you could describe that fairly as the stuff that's left over after everything more useful has been extracted from petroleum. It's like asphalt. You can walk on it. In fact, the ships have to warm it up just so that it becomes a fluid so they can burn it as fuel. So it's incredibly dirty. So a bigger ship where you can pack more goods on it and with other technological innovations to try and make the engines more efficient and regulating the speed carefully. It could be greener, but it's still there's a tremendous environmental footprint attached to moving goods that distance in that way. And it's not always accounted for. No country claims those emissions when we do these worldwide assessments of what the cargo fleet's emissions are because it happens outside international boundaries. So that they're off they're literally off the books, even though if the shipping fleet were a country, it would be among the top 10 emitters in the world, ahead of Germany, the fourth largest economy on the planet, and yet it doesn't count, so to speak. I think there's some experimentation going on different kinds of energy sources for shipping that might be less of a burden on the planet, but so far that hasn't really led to more than a talk and testing kind of phase.
But at the end of the day, is your conclusion that we're just moving too much stuff around all of the time, be it us or things?
I don't know. Everything has an unintended consequence, it seems to me, when it comes to transportation. Are we moving too much stuff? Well, the consumer economy is what it is. It's the engine keeping us afloat. Logistics is the new manufacturing in America. Being trained in the movement of goods is the surest way to get out of college and have a job waiting for you. So are we going to take all those jobs away? There's no easy solution in a consumer culture. So the first thing we have to look at, are we making the right choices to move the things we are moving efficiently? I mean, why are half the trips during rush hour non-work related? Because we impose no penalty other than getting stuck in traffic for making that choice because of the way we fund our roads. Other cities around the world have figured out, hey, you know, we can provide incentives to get people not to drive at that time and improve traffic without, you know, a single bulldozer. I feel that industry isn't paying its fair share. It only pays 10 cents more a gallon in the federal fuel tax than cars do. And yet a fully loaded big rig inflicts 10,000 times the wear and tear on a road than a car does. So they've been getting somewhat of a free ride, so to speak, on their contribution to our infrastructure.
Should we, as a public, be more educated about the travel costs involved in getting a cup of coffee? Should we label our products currently in terms of breakdown of nutrition, say? Should we have labeling that explains how many miles have been traveled to bring that coffee to us?
Sure. You talk about the cup of coffee. We were just talking about the beans. What about the cup? What about the packaging? What about the water? What about the electricity that powers your coffee maker and the filter? All those components are part of our daily consumption patterns, and they're all being sourced from all over the place. You know, even the gas that you pump into your tank in California, it's amazing. It's a petroleum cocktail. It comes from 14 different countries and four states, and by rail and pipeline and ship and truck, of course. And by the time you pump that gallon into your tank of your car, it's come 100,000 miles to get to you. That's just the fuel for movement has an entire movement story behind it.
Is it a collision of tech culture versus older traditional infrastructure culture? Because so much of these innovations have come from the tech community. All this Amazon door-to-door is old school infrastructure having to try and catch up with digitization.
It is. I mean, that's the hidden part of the same-day delivery holy grail of online retailing, which we're having now. You know, we have a diabetic cat who needs special food, which is unfortunate because he's not a very likable cat. But and this food is hard to get. You can't get it at the supermarket, and it's made in St. Louis. And so where do you get it? You get it on Amazon. And it was really revelatory the first time I bought it because I clicked on it, and 8 hours later, that same evening, it was on my doorstep. I don't know how they do that, you know, because there can't be that many people in my town who need diabetic cat food at a good price and with free shipping. And of course, the case of cans come in a much bigger box, and there's all that sort of extra packaging and room on the truck, which means ultimately more trucks. The magic of that has an unintended consequence, which is the crazy attempts by delivery companies to try and get it there on time, and the fleets of trucks and the startups needed to make those deliveries. You have Uber and Lyft now with delivery services. There's all kinds of new players. And on one hand, hey, great economic opportunity, more jobs. On the other hand, oh my God, where is all this traffic going to go? Within 20 years, we're going to see that goods movement double from the projections I've seen in the Los Angeles area. Where's it all going to go?
That was Edward Humes. His latest book is Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by JC Swatek. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.